Of all the tributes bestowed upon Theodore Roosevelt during and after his life, perhaps he would be most pleased that a national park is named in his honor, centered on the site of his Elkhorn Ranch in the Badlands of North Dakota. Listen to T.R.'s own description of the place, written during his first season of residency in the Badlands.
I grow very fond of this place, and it certainly has a desolate, grim beauty of its own that has a curious fascination for me. The grassy, scantily wooded bottoms through which the winding river flows are bounded by bare, jagged buttes. Their fantastic shapes and sharp, steep edges throw the most curious shadows under the cloudless, glaring sky. And at evening, I love to sit out in front of the hut and see their hard gray outlines gradually grow soft and purple as the flaming sunset by degrees softens and dies away.
Roosevelt's biographer, Edmund Morris, observed that, as one of many guardians of Theodore Roosevelt's memory, the North Dakota Badlands are the very sanctuary where his environmental conscience matured. It is true that he was a nature lover long before he built the Elkhorn Ranch here, but it was not until he settled in the Badlands and discovered the vulnerability of this fragile ecology to profit seekers from outside that he began to ponder the policies that culminated in his unsurpassed achievements as our first conservation president. To my mind, said Morris, there is no memorial of marble or bronze anywhere in the country that evokes the conscience of Theodore Roosevelt as powerfully as the Elkhorn Bottom and its surrounding hills. It is a crucible of calm, a refuge from the roar of worldly getting and spending. The very disappearance of the ranch T.R. built here, except for a few foundation stones, emphasizes the transitoriness of human achievement and the eternal recuperative powers of nature. Welcome to the Talk About Teddy podcast, weekly conversations exploring the world of Theodore Roosevelt. I'm your host, Kurt Skinner, and I'm joined as ever by my good friend and co-host, Larry Marple. Howdy, Larry.
Hello, Kurt. I've been really looking forward to this talk about what's become one of my most favorite places, Theodore Roosevelt National Park.
Yeah, me too, Larry.
There's something magical in the stark, desolate beauty of the Badlands, the song of the western meadowlark, and everywhere you look, you know Theodore Roosevelt saw this landscape, and it helped mold his conservation ethic.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. So what should our listeners know about today's guest, Valerie Dangler?
Valerie began her 31-year career with the National Park Service as a volunteer at Theodore Roosevelt National Park in North Dakota. She later worked as a park ranger and naturalist at TRNP. She also served at Colorado National Monument, Oregon Pipe Cactus National Monument, Badlands National Park, Petrified Forest National Park, and Big Bend National Park, Rio Grande Wild and Scenic River. Following time as superintendent of Scott's Bluff and Agate Fossil Beds National Monuments in Nebraska, she returned to TRNP in 2003 as superintendent, also overseeing the Knife River Indian Villages and Fort Union Trading Post National Historic Sites in North Dakota. She retired in 2014 as the longest-serving superintendent of Theodore Roosevelt National Park. Valerie holds a BA in biology from Eastern Oregon University and an MS in biology from the University of North Dakota. Following her retirement, Valerie served as a private consultant to the National Parks Conservation Association. She now works part-time for the Theodore Roosevelt Center at Dickinson State University and serves as a member of the Northern Rockies Regional Council for the NPCA.
Valerie Naylor, welcome to the Talk About Teddy podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to get you on, and we have a lot to talk about today. I guess, first of all, I was curious, how is it that Theodore Roosevelt is the only person to have a national park named in his honor? I mean, when did this idea originate?
So the park was an idea that was born probably in the 1920s. There were a lot of thoughts about tourism at that time. North Dakota had little, if any, tourism, and there were other national parks that were starting to attract automobile tourists as well as train tourists. And it was thought that it would be nice to make a national park in North Dakota. So there were a lot of people that were pushing for that from the tourism standpoint and the economic standpoint. They thought it would be a great idea. And so there was an organization called the National Park Highway Association of North Dakota, and then the Roosevelt Memorial Park Association in the 1920s, and they both pushed to have a national park established in that area. A lot of things went into that, and there was a lot of back and forth between the federal government and the state government and these private entities. But in about 1933, the State Historical Society of North Dakota got the Civilian Conservation Corps to come to the Medora area and to start building some infrastructure in and around what is now Theodore Roosevelt National Park. And the CCC was there, and later the ERA and the WPA, some of those alphabet groups. And so they built some structures and roads and such.
So were they thinking about, originally this could have just been a state park versus a national park? Or?
Yes, there was a lot of discussion about that. And at the start of it, it was thought it might be a national park, but the National Park Service wasn't keen on it at that time. And it became eventually a recreational demonstration area. And there were a number of these around the country. And the idea was that the National Park Service would give money and expertise to improve these areas, and then they would become state managed, a lot of them anyway. Mm-hmm. And so that was an idea for Theodore Roosevelt National Park area as well. And so the federal government, the National Park Service, thought that it would become a state park eventually. And at one point, they even put up a sign somewhere that said Roosevelt State Park, but it never was a state park. And the state really wanted it to be a federal park. And so there was a lot of back and forth in those days. And it was called the Roosevelt Regional State Park for a while, but it never really was that. So eventually, it became a National Memorial Park, and then much later, a national park. So that is probably the origin as far as how it became to be named as a national park after a person.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the CCC, and I know if you go to the Painted Canyon or the South unit, you can find a lot of the structures still there, the welcome signs, and even the old east entrance down in the
right.
South unit.
That's correct. We call those pylons. I think of a pylon as something that you put so you don't crash into something with your car. But we do call those historic pylons. Those are some of the entrance structures. Mm-hmm. And then there were culverts, historic culverts, which are amazing, actually. Beautiful.
Wow.
You know, you don't think of a culvert as being a work of art, but some of them were.
Yeah.
And they're historic structures now that were built by the CCC. And then there were some other structures in what is now the north unit of the park, a very famous overlook structure at the Riverbend Overlook, as well as some picnic structures near the campground and the old east entrance station in the south unit you mentioned. The National Park Service has preserved most of those early structures, but there are a couple that are no longer there.
Mm. Yeah, that overlook in the north unit is spectacular.
It is.
Yeah.
I consider it the most beautiful view in all of North Dakota, at the Riverbend Overlook in the North Unit.
I agree. Yes.
Well, I understood there was some confusion maybe early on when the park was designated. Was it an historic park or was it a natural park? And how to manage if you're going to emphasize one over the other?
Yes, that's complicated as well. You know, in the early days, as I mentioned, the National Park Service didn't really think it should be a national park. Mm-hmm. And it was through the efforts of Congressman William Lemke that eventually happened. And it was designated as Theodore Roosevelt National Memorial Park. And it was the only national memorial park in the country. And that was a compromise because it was established partially because of the association with Theodore Roosevelt. And that's how most people thought of it, was sort of a historical park having to do with Theodore Roosevelt. And you have to realize that then, as now, a lot of the people that are making these decisions had never been there.
Mm.
It's the same now with a lot of things that happen, not parks necessarily, but all kinds of things in the country. The people making the decisions don't have any firsthand knowledge of those things that they're making decisions about. And so in that case, it was thought that there must not be anything great there except for the association with Theodore Roosevelt. And so the compromise was that it was established finally in 1947 as Theodore Roosevelt National Memorial Park. So it wasn't a national park, but it was close. But it was the only one that was a national memorial park. Wow. And now that doesn't mean anything to those of us who work for the National Park Service. But it means something to some of the people in the country. They're looking to go to all the national parks that have a capital NP, you know, capital NP, capital national park, that are not national monuments or national lake shores or whatever. And then there are people that write books visiting the national parks, and Theodore Roosevelt National Memorial Park would be left out because it wasn't a national park. And it was just sort of there on its own. But as time went by, it became obvious that it was a Western national park, maybe not as large as Yellowstone or Glacier or Rocky Mountain, but it was a Western national park with all of the issues and all of the incredible natural resources that many of the other Western national parks had. But it also had the theme relating to the history and Theodore Roosevelt. So it was both a natural and a historic park in some ways, but overall, it's a natural park, so it eventually, in 1978, in an omnibus bill that changed a lot of things, the name was changed to Theodore Roosevelt National Park.
So, Valerie, for folks who have not yet been to Theodore Roosevelt National Park, how would you describe the physical layout of the park?
I think it's one of the most beautiful places in the national park system. It consists of badlands and prairie in western North Dakota. The park itself is about 70,448 acres, and it is in three different units. So the south unit is the largest. It's 46,000 plus acres, and Medora is the gateway community there. And so a lot of people that come off Interstate 94 go to the south unit. They stop at the Painted Canyon Overlook, they go to Medora, and they drive around the loop, maybe spend some more time there. Not as many people go to the north unit of the park, which is north of Belfield and south of Watford City on Highway 85. And the north unit is somewhat smaller, 24,000 acres, but the north unit has incredible scenery because of the way the Little Missouri flows through there, and the deepness of the cuts, and how you can go up high and look down and see for a long distance. And then the Elkhorn Ranch unit is only 218 acres, and it's between the two larger units, but it has that strong cultural connection with Theodore Roosevelt. So each unit is different, and they're all worth seeing for anyone who has that interest. When the park's name was changed to National Park from National Memorial Park in 1978, the wilderness area in the park was also established. And that's an area where there are no vehicles and that has the highest level of protection for land in the national park system. So the north unit, although it's only 24,000 acres, 19,000 plus acres of that is wilderness. So for a backcountry experience, the north unit is a really great place to go. Mm-hmm. The south unit has a little over 10,000 acres of wilderness, and that's all west of the river, not where the roads go. But the Petrified Forest, where a lot of people want to hike, is in the wilderness. And so that's an important aspect of the park. And because it is three separate units, it's a little more difficult to manage than if it were one big piece. Right, because you have more border area. So right. When you're talking about issues that could occur on the border, whether it's development or energy or whatever, it's a little more difficult when you have three separate units than if it's one big square.
Yeah, all tied together by the Little Missouri River. But
yeah.
Exactly,
but
the Little Missouri.
Three islands
river.
There, aren't they? They're within a sea of private lands and other development.
That's correct. The The land surrounding the park is a checkerboard of private and public land. A lot of it is the Little Missouri National Grassland that is managed by the U.S. Forest Service, and other parts are private. The Little Missouri River is a state scenic river, and it does connect all three units. It flows through the south unit, it flows just to the east of the Elkhorn Ranch unit, and then through a portion of the north unit, and then forms some of the south boundary there. So it does connect the three units, although there's no road that connects the three units directly. Mm-hmm. But the river does. And I've canoed a lot of that territory, all the way through the north unit, all the way through the south unit, and from the south unit to the Elkhorn. And so if you can get there at the right time of year, it's also nice to float the river. In the spring is the only time. But things are always changing. So I have floated that river maybe as late as September, but most years, May, June maybe, is the best time. And it depends on when the breakup is with the ice and when it's safe to do. But when Roosevelt traveled from his Maltese Cross Ranch to the Elkhorn Ranch, he often rode right along the river.
Yeah.
And so you do see a lot of what he saw when you float the river today.
Yeah, I know Edith Roosevelt mentioned that in 1890 when they came, they crossed the river, I think it was 23 times in a buckboard wagon that was springless to travel from Medora to the Elkhorn.
That's correct. And I think that would not be very comfortable because those banks are, they have changed, obviously. They change every year or so, but the banks are steep and there would be a lot of bouncing around. I can't think that would be very comfortable.
Yeah, but reading her description is fun.
Exactly. She had a lot of good insights about that.
She did.
I agree. I mean, to see an area from the river changes your whole perspective. A few years ago, I did a river trip with my son through Missouri and from Kansas City to St. Louis, and to see the state of Missouri from the river exclusively utterly changed my perception of that state. And so I can only imagine. I think that's going to be on my bucket list now, is to to go the length of the Little Missouri River in a canoe, perhaps.
Yes, the problem with planning a trip like that is that you never know when the water levels are going to be adequate. So you have to be very flexible. You can't just say, okay, we'll go on May 12th and go on May 12th, because that may not work. So that's why it's difficult and why it's a lot easier when you actually live there, because you can see when the levels are going to be good and get ready to go. But it's a difficult thing to plan, but many people have done it.
And that river can rise and fall 6 feet in one day.
Mm-hmm. And it can flood, too. And One year when I was there, I was out at all hours of the day and night, 5 a.m, going over to Theodore Roosevelt's cabin to make sure the floodwaters weren't compromising it. We had sandbagged it because the river came up right up to the edge of the cabin.
Oh.
And I was still worried about it, even though we had removed some artifacts and had it sandbagged, because I wouldn't be able to tolerate any water getting to the cabin. But it stayed away, fortunately. Our sandbags held, and the cabin wasn't damaged.
And you have times where you can stomp up and down in Little Missouri and maybe get your knees wet.
Exactly. But Roosevelt described it that way. He described it as sometimes a raging torrent and other times a string of shallow pools. And that is still true today, because it is a free-flowing river in North Dakota.
So in what ways has the park tried to link TR's experience to the Badlands with his conservation ethic?
Well, in the early days of when it was a national park, I actually worked there as a seasonal ranger. Mm-hmm. And we talked about Theodore Roosevelt in the context of his cabin, and we did do programs about Theodore Roosevelt, but he didn't have quite as much of a role in the park interpretation as what is done today, I think. And maybe that's not fair to say, but new exhibits were put in around that time and in the visitor center in the South Unit, and they focused a lot on Roosevelt. So I think prior to that time, maybe there wasn't as much about Roosevelt, but now, of course, that's a very important part of the park.
So today, I mean, how would you say that, that TR National Park interprets TR's experiences in the Badlands?
The park concentrates mostly on his time in the Badlands and what it meant to him. And it meant a lot, of course. As many people are aware, he grieved for his first wife while he was in the Badlands. It was a time when he could get to know regular people out on the range, cowboys and others that lived in areas that were rural, that were not cities, that weren't in the East. And it was a time when he could build up his own physical strength and his mental strength after the death of his wife. He also realized a lot of things during his time as a rancher there. He realized that the wildlife, some of the iconic wildlife, such as bison and elk, were disappearing fast. He himself had first gone to the North Dakota Badlands in 1883 to shoot a buffalo because he heard that was one of the last places where there were small groups of bison still around. And not long after that, there weren't any. And the elk were disappearing or were virtually gone from the area when he ranched there. And he was seeing that even the pronghorn and deer were in short supply. And he loved the wildlife because he was a hunter. And he cared very much about their existence, and he didn't want them to disappear. He didn't want others to not have that experience to see or to hunt them. And so that was something that became very obvious during his time there. He also intuitively knew that the level of grazing that was happening in the Badlands and other places in the West at that time was not sustainable.
Yeah.
He didn't have to be a long-term rancher to realize that. It wouldn't take much for it to not hold because the grass was being depleted so fast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So with the park today, what's the annual visitation rate?
Well, the visitation has increased a lot, and so I don't know the current numbers, but it has increased a lot in the last 40 years. It's increased a lot in the last 5 years, and a lot of that was the COVID effect during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. A lot of people went to national parks, and those numbers have stayed up in a lot of national parks. People were trying to get outside, get away from crowds, get away from urban areas. And so the numbers are high, much higher than they were even when I worked there.
So what does the typical visit look like to Theodore Roosevelt National Park versus perhaps what should the park traveler to TR National Park be certain to try to experience while they're in the Badlands?
It really depends on the person. The nice thing about national parks is each person can enjoy the part of it that is the most important to them. So some people drive along the interstate and they stop at a Painted Canyon overlook and they look out, and maybe they drive down into the town of Medora and take the loop drive around and then leave, and they're there for maybe 2 to 3 hours. And then there's others that stay in the campground for a week and take many hikes and explore the area. Or people that come just to canoe the river through the park, or that come to backpack in the wilderness area. And that's an important component of the park, that there is designated wilderness in both the north and south units of Theodore Roosevelt National Park.
Mm-hmm. Still a place where you can get away from folks pretty easily. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've found you get away from that paved loop there in the south park, and you venture into the trail a little bit, and you can suddenly find yourself pretty alone in the solitude of the Badlands if you're just willing to invest an hour's walk, it seems like.
Mm-hmm. That is very true in a lot of parks, and it's definitely true in Theodore Roosevelt National Park. But even on the road, it's not as crowded as a lot of the Western parks can be.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it is a great place to visit.
Unless you run into a bison traffic jam.
There are bison traffic jams, but you just need to learn how to deal with those.
Oh, yeah. I enjoy watching them, and we've had a few walk toward the automobile, and the look on both of our faces is, okay, do we back up? What do we do? Do we... So you retired as the longest serving superintendent of Theodore Roosevelt National Park. You were there from 2003 to 2014. And would you like to describe your career with the national parks and what you do now?
Well, I might start a little bit before that as it relates to Theodore Roosevelt National Park. My parents and I would go on summer vacations, like many people do, usually for 2 weeks. And we never talked specifically about wanting to see all the national parks or going to national parks. But we went to places that we thought would be interesting. My parents wanted to go there. They wanted to take me there. And they seemed to be mostly national parks when I think back on it. We went to a lot of them. And so in 1973, we took a trip that went through Wyoming and cut through the corner of Nebraska, went up to the South Dakota Badlands and Mount Rushmore, and then we went to Theodore Roosevelt National Park. And we started to take the loop road from Medora, and for some reason, my mother didn't like it. And we didn't get very far, I think maybe 3 or 4 miles into the park, and she says, I don't want to do this. I want to turn around. And so my dad turned around, and we left. And then we went up Highway 85 towards the north unit. And I remember like craning my neck to look in and try to see what I could see of the north unit from the road. Mm-hmm. And I was very disappointed because I thought it was absolutely fascinating. And I thought, oh, well, that's all right. I'll just come back here someday. And we went on and stayed the night somewhere in Montana or whatever. And anyway, so it was just about 6 years later when I was reading a catalog from the Student Conservation Association, which is a nonprofit that matches volunteers in national parks and other natural areas. And I was looking at the various jobs available for this summer. It's a volunteer job, but they would pay a stipend and transportation so you didn't lose money. And I saw jobs listed for Theodore Roosevelt National Park, and I said, that's it. And I applied, and you could apply to 4, and I put that as my first choice, and I got a call. And the supervisor said, you're the first person that's ever put it as their first choice, and we want to hire you. And so I went out there in the summer of 1979 as an SCA volunteer. We work right alongside the Interpretive Rangers, giving programs and working in the visitor center and such, and I spent my summer there. And then my goal was to go back as a paid ranger, which I did in the summers of 1980 and 81. And then I had applied to graduate school in North Dakota because I was in North Dakota. Mm-hmm. And I got an amazing offer from the University of North Dakota for a fellowship to do research in the North Dakota Badlands. Wow. So I did some ecological research in and around the park for 2 more summers. So I have a long history with the park in various different roles as a Student Conservation Association volunteer, a seasonal ranger, as a researcher. I even worked for the Theodore Roosevelt Nature and History Association, the cooperating association, for a short time. So I had that background. And I had this idea that I wanted to be a wildlife biologist. And there are, of course, wildlife biologists in the national parks, including Theodore Roosevelt National Park. But back in the 1980s, there were not many. And so I studied wildlife biology, but I realized in graduate school that that's not what I wanted to do. And so when I graduated, I wanted to get a job with the National Park Service and work in interpretation with the public, because that's what I really enjoyed. So what started at Theodore Roosevelt National Park took me to a variety of other parks throughout the western United States. And I worked in Colorado National Monument. I worked for the Corps of Engineers in California for a little while. I worked at Oregon Pipe Cactus National Monument in Arizona on the Mexican border, at Badlands National Park in South Dakota for quite a long time, 7 years. I did a special assignment at Petrified Forest National Park and then went to Big Bend National Park in Texas on the Mexican border. And then I got to be a superintendent in some other parks that I liked very much in western Nebraska, Scotts Bluff National Monument and Agate Fossil Beds National Monument. Wow. And when the job for Theodore Roosevelt opened up, it just seemed like the right thing to do. So I applied, and I got that job, too. They don't move us around as park rangers or superintendents. We have to apply and compete for all the jobs. So it was like a homecoming, really. So I had been gone for about 20 years from living in North Dakota and came back as superintendent at the same park where I started my career as a volunteer.
Wow.
I liked the symmetry to that. And after that, it was hard for me to really want to go anywhere else because I felt like it was a full circle thing, and I had a lot of investment in Theodore Roosevelt National Park. I cared about the park very much, and so I stayed until I decided to retire at a fairly young age because I wanted to do other things. So I was there for 11 and a half years as superintendent.
Wow.
Yeah, that's amazing to start and finish a long career with the Park Service in that same place. Yeah.
And at a place that you love. Yeah.
Yeah.
I did. I saw some changes. Yeah. You know, there were some, but since that was the first park I ever worked in, I always kind of judged other parks by that one, whether it was their signs or the trails or anything. I sort of looked at that as ideal in some ways. And so it was really great to come back and to be able to manage that park, as well as the other two National Park Service areas in North Dakota, Fort Union Trading Post National Historic Site and Knife River Indian Villages National Historic Site.
Mm-hmm. Being a superintendent of a park, that sounds like a pretty complex management job, and I'm sure there's a complex plan that goes with that. So what were some of the specific issues that you addressed during your tenure as superintendent at TR National Park?
Being a Park Service superintendent, I think, is a lot like being a mayor of a town. You have divisions. You have a maintenance or facility management division. You have a protection division, which includes law enforcement and emergency services. You have an interpretation division, which includes education. And then you have resource management, cultural and natural. And then you have administration, which, of course, makes everything come together. And so it's a lot like that. There's a lot of different balls in the air all the time. And it's really hard to plan because there are a lot of things coming in. Every day you never know what's going to happen, if someone's going to be lost in the park or there's going to be a bison out of the fence or who knows what. So it's something a little different every day. But a lot of it is about having a great team of people that work together to achieve the overall goals of the park. And when I was there, even though I was there a long time, I felt a little bit like I had three different jobs because the first few years, maybe from 2003 to 2007, the park was very focused on acquiring some land across from Theodore Roosevelt's Elkhorn Ranch. The ranchers that owned it really wanted to sell it, and they wanted to sell it to the national park because that, too, was part of Theodore Roosevelt's ranch. He ranched on both sides of the river, and the Park Service site on the west side of the river is only 218 acres. And they had about 5,200 acres where he would have ranched. And so that seems like an easy thing when you have a willing seller and a interested buyer, but it didn't become easy. It became very political. It went on a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually the way it ended up was that the U.S. Forest Service purchased that property. And that protected it from many of the threats that we were concerned might impact the Elkhorn Ranch unit of Theodore Roosevelt National Park. And then after that, we had an issue having to do with elk management. As the elk population grew, we started planning to come up with some ways to reduce that population in the park. And so that was probably, it overlapped with the Ebert's Ranch or the issue, but from 2004 to 2011, really, there was a long planning process and then implementation of some elk reduction. And then towards the end of my time there, from starting to 2010 until 2014, as everyone knows, we had an oil boom in western North Dakota. And so that was something we had to keep an eye on.
Yeah, so you were there really when the Bakken boom developed. And did you want to talk about any particular issues you had dealing with the resource extraction industries and, you know, the threat, obviously, to the management, particularly of the Elkhorn, perhaps?
Yeah.
Right. Our goal was to protect the park. the Park Service has nothing against oil development, and obviously that was happening. But during a boom, a lot of things are done in ways that are not well planned. And so we had to make sure that drilling or something else wouldn't happen right on the boundary of the park, where it would affect the scenic views for the next 20 years or do some damage to core values of the park. So we had to keep apprised of whatever specific proposals there were that might affect any of the three units of the park. And there were some that would have been devastating. But in many cases, we were able to work with the oil companies or the energy companies themselves and avert any kind of disaster there. And so just as an example, in North Dakota in 2012, there were 370 drilling rigs at the same time. And right now there's 37 approximately in North Dakota. Oh. So 10 times as many were drilling then as now. And so it's not so much how many wells are out there pumping, but it's the drilling that where they put in a big infrastructure that could affect the park's scenic views and sounds. So yes, we did work a lot on that with the state and also with other agencies and with the energy companies themselves to try to prevent any negative impacts on the park.
Wow. Yeah, that, you know, particularly when you're at the Elkhorn, since it, you know, that being Roosevelt's home base for much of the time that he's in the Badlands, and what a unique place that is, and how important that view shed and the soundscape there is. I didn't experience the Elkhorn at the height of the boom with all of the traffic going by, but I certainly read a number of the editorials. It sounded pretty dire for a while, but that seems to have improved, would you say, now?
Yes. Our main goal was to not have drilling apparatus visible from the park, especially the Elkhorn, but any part of the park, really, and at least not in close proximity. And then also the sound. At the Elkhorn, the sound is very important, because when you go out there and you walk the short trail and you sit where Theodore Roosevelt's home was there, it sounds and looks very much like it did in 1885 when he was there.
Yeah.
You still hear the same mourning doves that he wrote about. You hear the woodpeckers. You hear the wind and the cottonwood trees. Some of those trees were there even during his time. See and hear the river. You don't want to hear a generator or a pump or something like that. So we wanted to keep the Elkhorn free of that. And there were a few times when it was not, but for the most part, that was achieved. Because it is such a small unit of 218 acres.
Yeah.
It was harder to protect the boundaries than when you have a larger unit like the South Unit, which is 46,000 acres.
Yeah. I know the Elkhorn, we've mentioned it in other podcasts, that to me it's almost like a cathedral right there, to keep that sacred, to keep it from being disturbed. It's really
important. It's a very special place.
Yeah.
I've gone there 100 times, and back in the 1980s, it was a very hard place to get to, and there was no improved road there. Most people that did go there, and there weren't very many, would go from the other side of the river and then walk across the river to get to the Elkhorn Ranch. And even when I arrived there in 2003 as superintendent, there was a sign on the fence that said Department of Interior, but there was nothing really identifying it as the Elkhorn Ranch. So fortunately, we were able to work with others. We got some money for exhibits, and we put up a sign there at the entrance that said Elkhorn Ranch Unit, and then a limited number of appropriate interpretive signs along the trail that goes towards Theodore Roosevelt's cabin site so that people could learn about it while they were there. But we were very careful in placing those, and we don't want infrastructure from anyone else or from the National Park Service to affect those views and sounds of the Elkhorn. That was always the goal when I was there.
Our friend Rolf Sletten, who was recently on an episode talking about Roosevelt's ranches. I like the way he described it. He said the Elkhorn site today is essentially as Roosevelt found it and not as he left it in the 1890s. You go there today and you essentially see the way it was when Roosevelt first scouted it out for the construction of a cabin there.
That is true. The river has moved a little bit to the east, just from natural changes. And the cottonwood forest has moved a little bit. The small trees in his day are now the large trees. And then there's small trees out beyond them. It's very fascinating, really, because you can see the flood patterns of the river when looking at the cottonwoods. And there's a little more juniper in the area. There wasn't juniper in the area when Theodore Roosevelt was there. That's a plant that's native, but it tends to increase without fire. Okay. So some things have changed, but for the most part, it's very much like it was in Roosevelt's time. And he would recognize it, I'm quite sure.
Oh, yeah.
I was reading the history of the park, where it apparently the idea was floated in the 60s that the Elkhorn would be developed and reconstructed with all the cabin and the outbuildings and turn it into essentially a living history area. Completely commercialized, it sounds like, and I think anybody who goes there today is so grateful that the Park Service did not proceed with that kind of a plan.
There were many ideas for the Elkhorn Ranch starting at the very beginning, but fortunately some of those didn't materialize, and I'm very glad that it's the way it is today, so that people can go out there and experience it the way that Roosevelt experienced it. If they really want to learn about how the Badlands shaped Theodore Roosevelt, that is the place to go.
Yeah.
Leave it as it is, right?
Yes.
Man can only mar it.
Yeah. Well, before I forget, I wanted to circle back. You talked about originally your idea was that you might end up to be a wildlife biologist, but you are trained as a biologist with your undergrad and master's. I was wondering if you could talk about some of the original wildlife that TR would have known in the Badlands, and maybe some of the animals that the park actively manages today.
Right. Well, of course, when Roosevelt was there, the bison and the elk were mostly, if not totally, gone. There were white-tailed deer and mule deer, as there are now, and some pronghorn, although in decreased numbers. And so when the park was established, most of those animals were around, but the bison were gone and the elk were gone, and black-footed ferrets and a few other species. But the park wanted to actively restore bison to the area because that seemed pretty important for a natural park that has wonderful habitat for bison, and also because of the Roosevelt connection. And so in 1954, they started to fence the south unit in anticipation of reintroducing bison there. And that happened in 1956 with 29 bison that came from the Fort Niobrara National Wildlife Refuge in Nebraska. And then those numbers increased naturally, and in 1962 they moved some of them to the North Unit. And ever since then, both the South Unit and North Units of the park have had bison there, and people expect to see them when they come to the park. They do, however, require management because they have no native predators left. There are no wolves and there are no grizzly bears. And they are in an enclosed area. They are not supposed to go outside the fence. It does happen once in a while, but they are confined to the park, and so they do take some active management. So that is done by rounding them up and shipping them to partners and cooperators, primarily Native American tribes.
Well, for folks who haven't been to Theodore Roosevelt National Park, what does that require to keep a bison enclosed? And once you're inside the park then, as a visitor, what are the rules of engagement with the bison?
Yeah, the bison don't stay in with barbed wire. So there is a woven wire fence I think it's eight feet tall around the park. And that mostly keeps the bison inside. At Theodore Roosevelt National Park, they are allowed to roam throughout the entire park, except for in Medora and the area south of Interstate 94. And so they could be anywhere throughout most of the park. And people just need to learn how to deal with them. And so we do warn people about that. The bison could come in the campground, and they do. They could come to your backcountry tent when you're backpacking, or you may encounter one when you're on a hike, when you least expect it. So you have to be wary about that. And they are very dangerous animals. But the number of encounters or dangerous encounters that happen is pretty small, considering.
So you'd mentioned the elk numbers in the time that you were superintendent, managing the elk. What year were the elk reintroduced into the park, or about that time period at least?
Yeah, the elk were returned in March of 1985. They brought some from Wind Cave National Park. And at the time, people weren't sure how they would do there, whether they would take hold or not. And I'm not really sure why both the state and the National Park Service weren't sure, because it's really great habitat for elk. Yeah. We think of elk as being animals of the mountains, like the grizzly bears. But elk and grizzly bears were Great Plains animals, really. And they are in the mountains today because that's where they're forced to be, because on the plains we have farms and cities and such. And so it's great habitat for elk, and they did very, very well. And so a couple of times in 1993 and again in 2000, the park did round up some elk the way they did with the bison. It wasn't the best situation, but it did work, and the park was able to keep the elk population at manageable levels. And also the idea was that the elk would go out of the park too, unlike the bison. They would move in and out, and they could be hunted, and they would go out on private and federal lands surrounding the park. And so the elk population is managed, and they do go in and out of the park, and they are hunted in North Dakota.
Your role with the Theodore Roosevelt Center, we had Dr. Chris O'Brien, the director, on recently. How did that get started for you, and where has it taken you?
Yes, my role in that huge project of the Theodore Roosevelt Center, trying to digitize everything from, to, and about Theodore Roosevelt, is a very small role, but it's a fun one for me. And early on in the process of figuring out what the Theodore Roosevelt Center would digitize, we did have people that digitized the collections at Theodore Roosevelt National Park. And then the TR Center started working with the other national parks dedicated to Theodore Roosevelt and doing digitization there. And at one point, a ranger from Grand Canyon mentioned to Clay Jenkinson, who was very involved in the early stages of the Theodore Roosevelt Center, and he said, you know, we have some things at Grand Canyon. And that made us think that all of the parks that Theodore Roosevelt proclaimed as monuments, or that were established during his presidency, of which there are 23, that there may be interesting things in the collections of those parks that relate to Theodore Roosevelt. So when I retired, I wrote a little proposal to the Theodore Roosevelt Center that would be a job that I could do, that I could go to the 23 national parks and monuments that Theodore Roosevelt established, and I could work with the curators, and I could see what they might have in their collections, their archives, that would be of interest to the Theodore Roosevelt Center. And I've been doing that ever since, because it's not a job that is a full-time job. It's very, very part-time. And they don't pay my travel, so it's not like I go from one to another right away. But I travel constantly on my own, and while I'm doing that, I go to the parks and get their information. So it's taken me a while, but I'm finished with 22 out of 23 of those parks now.
Wow.
And it's been very interesting.
In future episodes about those 23 parks and monuments that were established by TR, what can we expect to hear about?
Yeah, I could tell you a lot about them. I've learned a lot about those parks. Many of them I had visited before, but some I had not. And so it was great for me to go with Theodore Roosevelt in mind and look through the collections. And sometimes that takes a couple of hours. Sometimes it takes a few days. It really depends on the park. And so I'd be happy to talk about that in a future episode. I also thought it would be great to talk about the parks that are dedicated to Theodore Roosevelt, because in addition to Theodore Roosevelt National Park, there are five other national park areas dedicated to TR. Mm-hmm. And the only other person that has the same number is Abraham Lincoln.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah.
So that is pretty significant, really, when you think about it. You're probably familiar with them, but there's Theodore Roosevelt Birthplace in New York City, Theodore Roosevelt Inaugural in Buffalo, New York. Of course, Theodore Roosevelt National Park in North Dakota, Mount Rushmore in South Dakota, Sagamore Hill on Long Island, and Theodore Roosevelt Island in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
So six parks dedicated to Theodore Roosevelt himself, and an equal number for Lincoln.
You go by a nickname, I understand.
Oh, the National Park Vagabond?
Yeah.
Will
you agree to be ours?
I'd love to, yes. I do have a goal to go to every National Park Service area in the country. And there are 426, I believe, at last count.
Wow.
I've been to about 353, I believe. And I have a few more to go, but I've made pretty good progress.
Yeah.
And I mentioned earlier that what a park is called is not as important as some people think. There are 63 national parks, but over 425 national park areas. And those of us who work for the National Park Service think of them all as sort of the same. If you worked at Devil's Tower National Monument, I wouldn't say, how are things in your monument? I'd say, how are things in the park? We think of them all as parks, even the smallest ones, if they're units of the national park system. And so for us, they're managed maybe a little differently based on the resources there, but they're all national parks, and they're all great, and they're all different.
Yeah.
And they teach us so much about our history, the history of the country, all the way from American Samoa to Alaska to the Virgin Islands to Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
To Guam.
Yeah. It's our national treasure, our national inheritance, as TR would say, right?
Right, exactly. And so I do have the goal of seeing every one of those national park areas, and I hope to make it. I've made pretty good progress so far. I make some progress every year. And doing the project on Theodore Roosevelt has helped me to learn more about some of those parks and why they were established, and it's been very interesting.
I can't wait to get to the next episode when we start delving into those memorial parks and the 23 parks that were established under TR's presidency. So, Valerie, this has been a wonderful conversation. We are so yeah. grateful that you agreed to come on the show.
Oh, it's great, and I wish you well with your podcast. I've listened to every episode so far, and it's all very interesting.
Well, that's our show for today. Thanks for listening. You can find this podcast on our website, talkaboutteddy.com, where you can see show notes and transcripts, links to resources, and additional TR content. And do please tell us what you think.
And if you've enjoyed our content, please consider subscribing and reviewing the podcast wherever you listen, and tell your friends and family about us, because it really does make a tremendous difference and it helps others find this show.
We hope you'll join us for the next episode of Talk About Teddy. And until then, as our friend TR would say, do what you can with what you have where you are.